Okay, today is January the 10th, 2013. This is Steve Labruda on behalf of the H.J. Lutcher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, I'm interviewing Coach Don Gambrill over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. First of all, I want to thank you, Coach, for taking the time out to talk with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm glad that you know you have such interest.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Where were you born, and where'd you grow up?
I was born in a town in Kansas, Altamont. It's right in the corner between by Oklahoma and Missouri borders. A town of about 1,000 people.
Oh wow!
Raised by my grandparents there.
Oh wow! Small town. Did you get involved with athletics as a kid or?
Well, we left there when I was about 9 years old and went to California, and so I grew up and went all the way from fifth grade through college in the Los Angeles area.
Okay, great, great. So, did you start swimming or did you what started your athletic pursuits or?
I was a self-taught swimmer. And just went to the pool a lot and finally learned to swim with my head above water. And at around 9, 10 years of age, I guess, because I'd never been to a swimming pool but once before I went to California. And actually what led to it was when I was friends with a couple of guys that were abalone diving, and I asked them to take me with them, so I started diving for abalone and spearfishing.
Wow.
When I was in about, I guess, 11th grade. And then summer, one of them worked at the pool, and they had a water polo team there that was recreational. They had different leagues throughout the city of Los Angeles, and so I played water polo, and you didn't have to swim except with your head above water, which is all I could do anyway. And we won the city championship, and then they had a swimming season after that, and just had inner pool races. Wow. And so I decided to try that, but I swam on my back because just swam hard till my head hit the wall. And that was my beginning to swimming, and I played football all the way through high school and all the way through college. And when I went to junior college at East Los Angeles Junior College, they had a swim team, and I went midterm in January, so it was a long time to football season, so I decided to go out for the swim team.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't know anything about swimming time, my time for the 25, the first day when a coach timed me, was 16.2, and of course that was without a breath. I went as hard as I could till I got to the wall. But because they had no pool, we had to go about 8 or 10 miles to a high school to practice every day. There were only about 9, 10 guys on the team.
Uh-huh.
And with the scoring system, which sets that you had to put two guys in every event, and they scored 3 places, so you automatically got 1 point. So I got put in all the events where they only had didn't have anybody to put in it, so they could put me in there, and I'd get 1 point for them. And that was my first year. That summer lifeguarding, I worked with L.A. City Pools as a lifeguard.
Mm-hmm.
And happened to work with a very good-looking, very good swimmer from North Hollywood. And I was driving about 20 miles a day to work.
Uh-huh.
And every day at noon, we'd go in and swim, and she'd just wipe the pool with me. But she went to UCLA, and like I say, was a very good swimmer.
Yeah.
And so I just tried real hard. By the time I came back, I'd progressed quite a bit that summer. And then the next year, I made junior college All-American in the 1500. Wow. When I'd never even swam that far before. The first race I swam, I had never swam that far before for that, and it made one of the top 10 times.
Wow.
in the nation, having delivered 14 miles a day, a paper route 7 days a week from the time I was 12 years of age through my first semester in college. I had a good aerobic background, so when I finally learned to swim, why, I was able to go a long ways, not very fast, but could with endurance. So that's how I got into swimming.
Mm-hmm.
Later, I went in the Navy And when I was in the Navy, I again played football at the Naval Training Center, and that was over there, they had a swim team, so I went out for that. And we really, really just got started in it, and it was 1956, mm-hmm. and they issued an order throughout the Navy that any swimmer with Olympic caliber shall be given an opportunity to train for the Olympics. Well, somebody saw in my file that I'd made junior college All-American, which, believe me, is a very low level of swimming. They decided because it was All-American, I should be up there. So they transferred me to Long Beach, which was right back home. I was married at that time.
Yes, sir.
And so I trained there, and there was about 12, 14 guys swimming on that team. And two of them did make the Olympic team, and I just was allowed to stay with them because I was assigned here and I worked hard. But that was about the end of it anyway, but it was a great, great deal for me. And then I'm shortening all this, if you believe it. I went on a ship at the end of that season. I had 10 months to go. By then, my wife was expecting our first child.
Uh-huh.
And the destroyer I got on went to Australia at the Olympic Games, the first ship's cruiser and four destroyers that had been there since the Battle of the Coral Sea. And so we landed there for the Olympic Games, and I was able to go to the Olympics and see the swimmers, and of course I knew a couple of them on the team. In those days, the security was nothing. They put a sweat top on me and took me in. I was able to eat in the Olympic Village and meet the other members of the team. So I, you know, had a great exposure to Olympic swimming.
No kidding.
When I come back, then I played football and graduated. Played football another year at LA State. I'd been at Occidental. Both President Obama and I went there. Neither one of us graduated there, but we both went there.
Yes, sir.
And anyway, that's what I did. And I that last year when I was going to school, after I got through practice in the evening, I went to high school with a former coach of mine, was a varsity coach. He gave me the JV team, so I coached the junior varsity team for no money, just to, you know, intern, I guess you'd say.
Sure.
And that led to one of his assistants getting a head job. I really had another year of eligibility for football, but I was able to graduate that summer, and they offered me a job on a provisional credential with no practice teaching, nothing, to come in and work with their football.
Wow.
And then they saw that I'd been a swimmer and they needed a coach, so they said, well, you take the swim team too. So that started in 1958. In 1960, I had a South African that trained with me that was on the South African Olympic team. He made the final in Rome.
Uh-huh.
And then I started a women's team along with the men's team. I was coaching a club team as well as high school.
What made you start a women's team?
Some of the little sisters of brothers that came down.
Oh, outstanding.
And so I just, you know, it was fine. We just put them in and started swimming. Well, anyway, the first nationals that I actually went to then, 1961, I took one girl, went to the nationals, and she placed fifth or sixth in the 1500.
Uh-huh.
Come back, they had the men's meet, and I had one guy that made two finals as a sophomore in high school, and he broke two national high school records earlier that year. Then in 1964, three of these girls that I'd been training made the Olympic team.
Wow.
One of them won three gold and a silver medal and broke two world records. The second one broke a world record, and so I was an expert.
Wow.
That's how it happened. And at that point, I went on to, and I'd had 7 years coaching in two different high schools.
Uh-huh.
I went to a junior college then, and then was there 2 years at Pasadena City College. Went on to Long Beach State. Was there 4 years, and the team the year before I went there had never they didn't score a point in the NCAA, of course, and had lost all their dual meets, and we had only lost to SC and UCLA that first year, and got won the college division national, and we could go on to the university. We won the university or the college division and got 11th in university the first year,
mm-hmm.
and then we were seventh, and fifth the next 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I went to Harvard University and was there for 2 years. We won the league the second year, and beat Yale. They hadn't beaten them but two times previously in 30-some years.
Wow.
Then I did a clinic in Alabama and met Coach Bryant, saw a football game, and just had a wonderful weekend.
Oh, yeah.
And that spring, the coach come to me at the Nationals and said that they were going to go for a full-time coach. He was doing recreation and running the pool and coaching, and he was in his mid to late 60s. He said, I'm going to be getting out of it, and Coach Bryant wants to know. I recommended you, and Coach Bryant wanted to know if you'd be interested. So I flew down, was able to get the job, and we've been here 4 years.
Wow. Wow, that's outstanding. You had some pretty early success in your coaching, did you? What were your influences when you started?
Yeah, I guess blind luck. Well, the one thing I always believed in was hard work. At that time, there weren't many textbooks out. Kippis had one small one out that he'd put out, from Yale University.
Sure.
And then after I'd been coaching about 10 years, actually, Doc Counsell came out with the first really great book. Forbes Carlisle had one in 64 that I read not too long before our Olympic trials and was very pleased to see that most of the things he was recommending I was doing. So anyway, we won a national championship with our women's team in 65, and then in 69, 70, 71, we won men's, these are AAU championships.
Yeah.
Won three men's AAU championships, and by then I'd had six or seven world record holders, and several more on the 68 Olympic team. I had three of the four relay swimmers were my sprinters. And another boy had broken the world record in the 400. So, it was just a lot of hard work and a lot of good athletes to work with. And right. When you have good athletes, well, it kind of tends to draw others to come and train. I had people all over the country coming in the summer to train. So it just was kind of a learn by trials situation, actually.
Sure.
I can remember Eddie Reese. we'd go to Nationals, and you can ask Eddie.
Uh-huh.
He'd just follow me around, things like that, and he's a nice young guy. And
yep.
And I suppose he's 10 years younger than I am, so I was 28 then, and he was 18 or 19, because I'm just out of college anyway.
Right.
And he would go with us and just sit and listen and talk and, soak up everything he could. And I had done the same thing previous to that myself. I'd go and whenever I'd find guys like Councilman or some of those guys, I'd just go sit down there and listen to them and all the stories they told. And the fraternity in coaching and swimming is that way. It's not something where everybody jealously guards everything they've got. They sit and talk about everything they do and what they're doing. And if you're doing what everybody's doing last year, you're way behind. You've got to find something different to do this year.
Wow, yeah. Absolutely, and that probably speaks bodes well for why you were so successful and some of your things. What were your influences in getting people to swim for you or join the team? Did you just take anybody back then?
Well, when I started out, there were a lot of swim schools in Southern California,
sure.
And they all had little teams. And I had a 50-meter year-round pool, so kind of at the end of every summer, the better swimmers would gravitate over to where they could swim during the winter.
Uh-huh.
And, so I picked up a lot of talent that way, especially all those girls. All the girls on our 65 team, I had ever since they were 11, 12-year-old girls. And it was, again, it was, I think, because of all the talent that was being developed and all the kids that were learning to swim in the little swim schools and the teams they had, that, that these other swimmers, got started and got an early start and had been taught pretty well, fundamentally, and then put them to hard work and just, a good team morale and everybody working hard. Actually, the women's championship we won, I trained 18 girls at a 4-lane, 25-yard pool for that national championship.
Wow.
And we didn't swim circle pattern those days. It was no lane lines in it. It was just kind of smash through with the fittest.
So more similar to your water polo days.
That's right.
Outstanding. So let's come up to just before the 68 Olympics. In 67, 68, were you already in Alabama at that time?
No, I didn't come to Alabama until I went to Harvard in 71 and Alabama in 73.
Oh, okay.
So I actually, I was on the 68 team. I was on five successive Olympic teams. So actually, when I was at Harvard, I was selected as for the second team, which was the Munich Olympics.
Right.
And then when I was in Alabama, it was Montreal next and the successive three Olympics.
Sure. Okay. 68 was your first where you were on the coaching staff.
Right. Right.
How did that come about? Tell me about
Probably one of the biggest things that led to it, as I told you, the success I'd had with the women in 64, and I had some young men coming along that were doing pretty well as well that went to Olympic trials with us. And then in 65, I did a month-long tour to South Africa with one of my world record holders.
Wow.
And that led on a few years later to a swimmer I'd met there, came to school here at Alabama, and broke the world record to 100, Johnny Skinner.
Uh-huh.
And in 66, I was selected to take the first team to Russia to compete.
Okay.
With the Russians, a men and women's team. And we had great success there. It didn't appear that we would, but we did. It was Don Scholeder who, you know, won four Olympic medals,
yeah, absolutely,
gold medals, and a whole slew of great U.S. swimmers. And we swam very, very well there. We had a shakedown meet in Poland, and then went on to Russia.
Uh-huh.
So we came back, and then they had not too long after that, they had the selection for the coach for 68. And George Haynes was easily the head coach, and it was a real surprise that I was the men's assistant. The next week they were having a women's coaching selection, and I had been trumped to be the women's head coach. But when I had a chance to take the men's, and I just started a four-year college at Long Beach,
uh-huh,
but I felt much better for my future if I stayed with the men's team. So I went with, you know, took that and took my name off the women's list.
Right.
And it, you know, I think was a good move on my part.
Yeah.
The three times I was assistant men's coach, the first time was George Haynes, the second time was Peter Daly, and the third time was Doc Councilman.
Wow.
That's pretty good people to be learning from.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Were you, how'd you feel when you got was it a phone call that Coach Haynes said that you would be?
No, I was actually on the committee that was doing the selecting.
Oh, wow.
It was a closed vote. And Peter Daly and I were co-coaching a club at that time, and I was one of the nominees, as was he. And I expected he was going to be the assistant coach. He'd been the head women's coach in 64, and I figured everybody, I think, thought it was that way. And they had the secret ballot, and there were only about, as I call, 12, 13 people on the committee.
Wow.
And I voted for Peter, and then when they got ready to do the counting, they said, okay, we've got 8 votes for one person, we've got 3 votes for another and 1 for another, something like that. So everybody said, all right, well, the one with 8 votes is, you know, that has to be the head coach because he's got a majority. So that, you know, that was George.
Right.
And at that point, then when they announced who the other coaches were, then I realized that that I was going to be the men's assistant. And quite frankly, it was because I feel that most of the people on that committee were college coaches, and I think they voted against Peter because of the recruiting value it would have been for him with men swimming for his college team.
Oh, wow.
And I was a young guy and had been successful, and so I think I was just in the right place at the right time and was selected as assistant coach. Peter was not even the top three. Red Barr from SMU was the other one, and when I knew that the runoff was between Red Barr and I, Peter didn't make the runoff.
Yeah.
When I knew it was between Red and I, then I knew that I was going to win. So I voted for myself second time.
Well, that's good. Where was Peter coaching at the time?
Well, he was coaching USC. That's the only college that he ever coached.
Yeah.
And, he and I were roommates, and you know, as I say, we were coaching our summer club together. At that time, it was the LA Athletic Club. We were co-coaches. But I was between jobs and pools for a couple of years, and so we just joined our team together, and then later went our separate ways again once I got to Long Beach. But, you know, I was rooming with him. I had to go back and tell him that he wasn't, you know, he wasn't selected. I said, what's more? I said, I was. And he said, well, I guess I'll just have to work harder the next 4 years. So the next 4 years he was head coach and I was his assistant.
Oh, outstanding. God, that's great. That's great. Do you guys, is he still with us? I mean,
yes, he is. He's 92 years old. I sat by him in the last two Olympic trials and we've had a wonderful time. He's very, you know, he's very alert and knows what's going on and you know, both of his parents died in their mid-90s and he's got their genes and doing very well.
Outstanding. God, that is just, that warms my heart. That is outstanding. Let's talk a little bit about the 68 trials. Those were held in basically your hometown at that time.
That's right, in our home pool where we were training. It had only been built and completed a month or so before that, so we had barely just started training in that pool.
Right.
But it was held at the Long Beach Plaza. The Belmont Plaza actually is the name of the pool.
Yeah, how was that experience for you?
Well, it was great. I had in the 100 freestyle, they take four, and I had first, second, and fourth.
Wow.
And Don Scholander, who was a favorite, didn't make the relay.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Spitz placed third. And so I had three-fourths of that relay on the first event. And then I also had a girl that made the 1500 in the women's. She's a former world record holder, made the 1500. Actually, it was 800 for women in the women's meet.
Yeah. Was Susie Atwood one of yours?
No, she wasn't. She swam at Lakewood, a neighboring team there with Jim Montrella, and she didn't really come into her own until 72.
Right, absolutely, yeah. I just recently did an interview with her.
She's a sweetheart.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, just a delight. As a matter of fact, everyone that
Have you done Kim Rebrecht yet?
I have not, and I don't know if anyone else has.
Okay.
But
she used to be one of my swimmers. At that time, she was swimming with Lakewood, same as Susie.
Yeah.
But
outstanding.
But Susie wasn't on the 68 team, was she?
Yeah, she was. She was, but she was either an alternate or she didn't medal.
I can remember that she was even on that team. I coached, you know, just the men.
Yeah.
I'd forgotten that she was even on the team.
Yeah, she was like 15.
She went on to be great, you know, and world record holder.
Oh,
and,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, and she's doing great, too. She came to the reunion here in Austin this last semester.
I went to the trials. They have a reunion there for the 10th, 20th, and 40th every year.
That's fantastic.
And seems on five Olympic teams, I have one every year.
Absolutely.
So I got to see an awful lot of former swimmers and kids that, you know, I had a chance to work with.
That's fantastic. We have found that getting together the 68 team seems to be easier than any of the other teams. You guys have a Facebook page and everything else. It's quite astounding.
Well, that depends on leadership, and Kim Reck and Tom Lowe are the ones that really have, you know, really flogged this thing along. And
yes, sir.
And I'm sitting here right now with 3,800 unread emails.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, I go through every day the new ones and try to catch up with others as I can, but I refuse to sit here 10 hours a day on a computer.
That's absolutely. That's a full-time job. You might as well be coaching. your kids did really, really well at the trials, so then you went to for prep at the Air Force Academy, correct?
Yes, we were up there for a month.
Yeah.
Training it, and you walk right into the pool and it's written right on the wall, 7,200 feet, welcome to the Air Force Academy, 7,200 feet. Kind of psychs out any visiting team that's coming in there. And they just turned the pole over to us, and it was great. I took the distance swimmers, and we went up to cabins. We had a couple of cabins at 10,000 feet, and we spent all our time up there except when we were actually in the pool.
Wow.
The rest of the team stayed down at the Broadmoor Hotel. We went up there, came down and trained, and had our lunch meal and our dinner there, and went back up. And kept them at higher altitude, trying to get as many, as many red blood cells as we could possibly create in a month.
Yeah, absolutely. And where were you? Were did you help decide that, or where was that with the?
I don't remember how that came about. I imagine it. I don't think it was, came from George or I. I think it was probably from some of the people with more of a scientific background. I imagine Councilman probably had something to do with it. I don't know.
Sure.
But one of the kids on the team had been from Indiana. He was just a high school kid, and he had been training there at the Air Force Academy. Took off a semester of school and went up and was training at the Air Force Academy for better part of a year leading up to that.
Wow.
Judd Kinsella.
Yeah, wow, absolutely. And I think from what I gather from our other Olympians, they thought it was a really, really smart decision to do that.
I think it probably was. I know Mike Burton won both the 400 and the 1500. And, of course, he was one of the guys that was up there. Had everybody that was swimming 400 and above, and also the breaststroker. It seems staying underwater for that breaststroke turn really hits them hard at altitude. So we had breaststrokers up there, too. We had a couple station wagons full of swimmers driving back and forth. It's about a 15, 20-mile drive up the mountain.
Yeah. Wow. That's great. The facilities are pretty spectacular. Was that your impression as well?
At the Air Force Academy?
Yes, sir.
At that time, yes. I'm sure they got the same pool now. In fact, one of my former swimmers, NC2A champion, is a women's coach up there. But I doubt if they've changed pools. But they'd had the NC2A championship there a year or two beforehand and held them at altitude. They've done that twice, once at Salt Lake and once at the Air Force Academy.
Right. Well, that's great. Were you paid to be an Olympic coach?
Yeah, we got $2 a day. Everybody on the team, including the athletes, we got $2 a day, laundry fee or whatever they called it.
Outstanding. So you were definitely in the money.
Yep. I think by the time I finished in 1984, I think we got 10.
Outstanding. What kind of relationships with the obviously you were pretty close with other coaches and everything else. Did you interact with anyone else besides the swim coaches?
You mean on the team?
Yes, sir.
Not really. In Mexico we were. Let's see. I'm trying to think. I'm going to tell you this right now. I believe we were the first week, or maybe, yeah, we were the first week then. They used to have it when it was in Australia, where swimming was the second week, but we were the first week in Mexico City.
Yes, sir.
I stayed afterward and watched, a lot of track and field.
Right.
And I really don't recall. I knew a couple coaches from other sports that I'd known beforehand, but I don't recall really spending any time or saving any time whatsoever with anybody, except the swimmers.
Okay, great. Do you remember anything about the Harvard crew letter or anything else?
Been at Harvard, I knew the Harvard crew coach.
Right.
And that was after the fact, when I went to Harvard. But I remember one of the things that the only thing I remember any disturbances at all that they had. We had to go out two times, the whole Olympic team together, and practice marching to come into the stadium.
Okay.
So all be in step and all that, and they actually drilled us up and down the field. Now, I don't know if you've been to the Olympics or not, but now when they come in, they're just all over everywhere. It looks like Times Square in New York as a team, the United States team comes in, there, people run around taking pictures, and they just mob scene around the track to their spot. But in those days, it was a very formal thing, and everybody had to be in uniform, and you couldn't take any cameras. Supposedly, all everybody took a camera in their pocket, but it was. And then also they were having a big squabble over some of the women they felt were men that were competing. So they were taking, as I recall, hair from the head and testing them to see, I guess, what their genes were or something.
Yeah, actually, that was the very first Olympics that they actually tested for gender. Yes, sir.
Yeah. And then 72 was the first we did the drug testing, the urinalysis and things like that. But they started the hair, and that, as I recall. And then I remember, of course, the track thing. I was there when the guys in the, I think it was in the 200, wasn't it, where
yes, sir.
Carlos and those guys raised their fists with the black power. So
yeah,
black glove on their hand.
Yeah, what did you think about that?
Well, you know, the only thing that I was concerned about, there had actually been some talk about boycotting the Olympics and not competing and things like that. Just a few people around. I don't recall nothing really organized. But then there, and also even clear in Montreal, there was things about, you know, maybe we should just boycott this or something. In Montreal, it was a different situation over some of the Chinese or Singapore or something like that. But anyway, there was, you know, people that were talking that way about, well, maybe we shouldn't even take part in this Olympics and things like that. And they had a big political thing in Mexico and shot about 18 or 20 people or something.
Yeah.
That were, you know, they had, I guess a lot of them were boycotted because they spent so much money to have the Olympics and there were so many poor people in Mexico. And when we drove and went into the stadium for the opening ceremony, about a quarter to a half mile out, shoulder to shoulder on the, as you drive in, were armed military with their guns and helmets and battle dress standing right there, you know. So if there had been any huge protests that day, it would have been unbelievable bloodshed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Did you have any apprehension at all before you headed down to Mexico City about security issues or anything like that?
Not me personally. I was so excited to be going down there that I never gave it a thought. And I don't recall any talks on the team, you know, of anybody that, you know, had a real concern.
No, matter of fact, all the athletes that I've talked to, they're just happy to be there. Let me get at it.
Yep.
Kind of stuff. What were your impressions of Mexico City when you guys arrived?
Well, again, we didn't see too much of the city. We were in a village, but we were fairly far from the swimming site. I don't remember how far now, but it must have been 8 or 10 miles anyway. It was a short drive compared to all the other Olympics I'd been to. Were just very short, and some of them we could just walk across the street. But there we had a fairly long drive. In fact, one day, one of the buses got held up by I don't remember if it was a marathon or something, and got there where the swimmer got there too late to swim.
Wow.
In his heat.
Right. Oh, my goodness. Did you guys go down early? How early before the game started were you?
As I recall, I think we were there about a week early.
Yeah, about a week early. I know the divers went down really early. I mean, I was talking to Hobie a couple weeks ago, and he said that they went down there almost like 3 weeks prior. So
I get a little mixed up between the two because I went down for the 67. They had a pre-Olympic meet down there, and I took the men's team down to that. George couldn't go, so they had me take the men's team down. And so we were there, and I get the two mixed up, frankly, now between pools that we went on, outlying pools. You couldn't work out in the pool, the Olympic pool. You got like 1 or 2 hours a day or something, but you got another workout in another pool on the outlying section. We went out to those, and we did the same in 67. So I get a little mixed up on which year was which.
Nah, no worries. You're doing great. What did you think of the venue down there in Mexico?
Well, the Olympic pool itself, you know, was fine. We had, I don't think we had any complaint with it at all. And the altitude didn't seem to be a factor except in the longer races. And there were a couple athletes that were a little disturbed by it, you know, just simply because of less air. And but I don't remember really affecting anybody. I think that it caused any change in a result in an event.
Right. What were your accommodations like? Did you stay the exact same building as last
year's
team?
Oh, yes. In fact, I can't remember. I think we were on third or fourth floor, and I personally walked the steps every day. I said I was going to do that until we got 20 medals or however many it was. And when we get our 10 gold medals, I'll stop and ride the elevator or something. So most of the time I was running up and down the stairs all the time. But no, they were adequate, and the food they brought in, I think, food for us that was different, maybe from some of the what the other teams were eating.
Mm-hmm.
But we did have a couple people that got their the trots down there. Mike Burton was one of them.
Yeah.
And right, his was. Have you talked to him yet?
You know, I haven't personally. No.
Well, right up to the day he was, the day or day before he was going to swim, he was. You know, he was really sick.
Yeah.
And then he asked either me or George. I remember we were both there, and he said, "What do you think it'll take to win?" And said 408 or 409 or something. Right at And he says, "Well, I'm going 408." And he jumped in and did it. And then he had another day or two to wait, and then he got swim the 1500. And by then he was getting better all the time. But
right.
He won both of them.
Oh man, that's outstanding. That's great. You touched a little bit about the opening ceremonies. Was all your marching practice well worth it? Did you participate? Were you with the team?
Well, when it got time to march, all the coaches and officials, we were all put in the grandstands and didn't get to go in the opening ceremony.
Oh goodness!
And that was that was the only one out of the five times. Well, of course, we didn't go to. To Moscow.
Right.
But in all the others, we did march and march with the team. But for some reason, they decided to cut down on the size of the groups that were coming in or something. So we were all sitting in the stands.
Yeah. What'd you think? That must have been kind of a letdown for you. I bet you wanted
to. Well, it was. But at the same time, as young as I was and excited as I was to be there, I wasn't complaining about anything. And yet, when I did march in the opening ceremony and saw how much it meant, I realized how much we really missed, because it was it's something. When you walk in L.A., it was just imagine walking in there with 90 some thousand people, and in the Coliseum, and gosh, what a feeling.
Yes, sir. Absolutely, I agree with you. Did you interact while you were down there with people from other teams, different nations and everything else?
Well, I've always coached a lot of teams, a lot of swimmers from other teams,
sure.
And that were competing in the Olympics. So naturally, I knew a lot of the coaches. I've lectured in over 54 different countries over the years, and had already been to several then. So I did know several people and coaches and things like that. And of course, I was there as a college coach. So I probably a little bit of recruiting interest too.
Yes, sir. And
I brought back three great swimmers from Mexico City.
Outstanding.
Two of them went on to be world record holders.
Outstanding. So it was a recruiting trip for you. That's
well,
wonderful.
You bet. I mean, anytime a college coach goes anywhere, it's a recruiting trip.
Absolutely.
You don't have any days off from recruiting.
No, sir. So 68 was the height of the Cold War and Vietnam. And being a former sailor yourself, do you think the political climate had any effect on the games at the time?
No, I don't, honestly. I don't recall, but I'm sure there were some countries that didn't come, but no major ones like in 1980. I can remember back when I took the team to Russia, we were sitting in Poland, and we had an interpreter, a female interpreter who was... had been assigned to us,
mm-hmm.
And she was out in the evening with me as well, and I was sitting with some other coaches, and we couldn't really converse too well. She was interpreting for us, and she says, "Mr. Gambrill, may I ask you one rather personal question, please?" And I said, "Sure." And she says, "Why is the United States in Vietnam?" I said, "You only have one question, huh?" I just told her, "Don't ask me."
Yeah, that's not personal at all. That's
I haven't figured it out yet.
Outstanding. What were your impressions about the Soviet coaches and the Soviet bloc athletes?
Well, in 1956 they kept them on a ship and didn't even let them go into village. So
yeah.
they relaxed a lot, a great deal by the time they were there. And of course, I knew a couple of the Russian coaches by then, having been to Russia just recently,
sure.
As well as a couple of their athletes. So, I had some limited conversations with them, and I always got along well with them. They were very, very businesslike, and when I was in Russia, they wanted to know if they could take pictures of our swimmers underwater and things like that, and I talked to the team. They didn't have any objections, so a lot of them did a lot of different things that I'm sure set them back 10 years if they tried to copy what they filmed, but it was pretty interesting, and the girls would talk to each other in pig Latin, and I don't know how they do that. They put a valve in the middle by a consonant or something anyway, and they blah, 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 like that, and they'd tell each other what they were going to do as they were filming them, and they must have taken 10,000 foot of Don Scholander alone.
Wow.
Just everything he did, you know, so he'd go over there and stretch out and just do different things on the deck that he never would do normally, just to let them burn film. They made a big game out of it. So they asked me. I said, well, now can I see your breaststrokers train? Because they're the best in the world. And they said, sure. Who would you like to see? So I told them there are two or three Povomichkova and two or three of their top swimmers.
Yeah.
And so they said, okay, we'll pick you up at 10 o'clock and you can see them train. So they picked me up at 10 o'clock. I went there, and the only ones were there were the ones I'd asked for by name. No coaches, no interpreter. I sat there for an hour watching them do what they wanted to do in the pool, so it was absolutely a waste of time. But right. they'd complied with what I asked for.
Wow. at the very minimum. And this was the beginnings of the East Germans' run for their
yes, Roland Mathis was there, the backstroker that won, to be the world great. In fact, Charlie Hickox, our best backstroker, knew that he couldn't beat Roland Mathis a year or two out, so Doc switched him to primary NIM, and he won the 200 IM, and went away from his best strokes, actually, because he didn't feel he could win gold medals in that, so he became an IMer for that meet.
Yeah. Were you aware at this time, at your very your first coaching Olympics, about the list for banned substances and things like that?
Okay. I didn't even know there was one then. I did by 72, but we still weren't very familiar with it.
Right.
You remember we had Rick DeMont that was disqualified on our team.
Yeah.
Because he had an asthma attack the night before, and he'd listed his medication that he took with his breathalyzer or whatever they call it.
Yeah.
And the doctors just let it go by and didn't catch it. So he only used what he had written down that he did use. If they would have caught that, they could have made a change in it and saved him that. And he also didn't get to swim the 1500, cost him 2 gold medals.
Yeah, no kidding. Absolutely. Goodness. What is your at this time, especially with the GDR, I mean, we know everything about. We have all their documents. Matter of fact, here at the University of Texas, we have all their documents about their program, their steroid program that they had. Were you even aware at that time or anything else?
No, not really. At that particular time, it seemed to be more influential in track and field and the weight in, wrestlers, lifters, things like that. I don't know that at least I had never had given it as a coach any thought whatsoever.
Right.
Now, by the time it got up in deep, but before 72, it was completely different. But at that point, if they weren't testing and doing anything, and I would think there'd have been a point in my career where if somebody had said, well, you're strong, I thought that it built bulk and you worst thing a swimmer could do would do something like that. But I'm quite sure that there were some American swimming coaches that were a little more advanced that were using it with some of their swimmers, in the early 70s,
right,
before they really began testing so much. Point of interest, I'm on the board of the USADA board of directors.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Right now you are?
Yes, sir.
Okay, outstanding.
I've been for 4 years. I'm the coach representative. They have a couple of athletes and one coach representative on a board of 10.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. That's fantastic. So you definitely you're not coaching, but it's great to have such experience on USADA's board for sure. Did you have any? I know they tested, like you said, they tested for gender. Did that seem kind of odd to you?
Well, when you looked at a couple, they're women shot putters and things. No. And, right. And you know, jumping all the way up to 1978 World Championships, we were staying in the same hotel with the East Germans, uh-huh. And I just stepped on the elevator, wasn't paying any attention, started to go up in the hotel. We were staying in hotels, not a village, and I heard this blah 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 talk like that. The elevator stopped, and about four girls passed me, went out. The girls from their swimming team.
Right.
My mouth just dropped open because I thought there were guys back there. I never even gave a thought that there were girls.
Actually, I've gotten that impression from a couple of the women swimmers. Matter of fact, they're saying the exact same thing. They're like, they can't possibly be women.
Yeah. Boy, by 72, it was it was so obvious then that. But in 68, I personally had wouldn't have given it a thought, or had given it a thought. Now I'm sure somebody more involved in the scientific end, like Doc, he probably is very aware of a lot of it.
But, oh yeah.
But I was not, and I was just working mine as hard as I could.
Absolutely. Well, we touch a little bit about the Smith and Carlos's little protest on the were you at that medal ceremony at the time?
No, I can't remember. Honestly, I can't remember if I was or if I wasn't. I don't think I was. But I think I would remember for sure if I was, and I don't. But I read so much about it; it was so much of a topic,
sure,
that I seemed so familiar with it. But I don't think I was there. No.
Did you? What did you feel about the salute, if you will?
At the time? I've always been so much of a coach and so much of a purist and anything like that, that I never want anything political to intervene in anything we do. Now that may be right, may not be, maybe wrong and not right. I don't know, but that's
sure.
The way I've always felt. I can remember talking to some of the guys that were talking boycott in 76 because they knew some of the swimmers in Singapore that weren't allowed to come to the games. But I guess it was Taiwan, not Singapore.
Yeah, it's Taiwan. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
And and I was just telling them, it's ridiculous for you to talk like this. And if you're prostituting yourself and what you've worked your whole life for something like this, it will do no good. And that's the way. I've never been very much of a union man, I don't think.
Right. No. I can understand. So your initial impression has not changed at all over the years, it sounds. Is that?
Well, I certainly am a lot different now than I was then. At that particular time, I had a short haircut, and I had it for 25 years, and it was a time when I wouldn't let any of my football players or anybody on my swim team, anything like that, have any hair over a half inch long. And, I've made a lot of changes, and one of the biggest changes was when after I went to Harvard and worked with those guys for a couple of years.
Yep.
Because I went onto a team there where I had guys that had hair down to their shoulders, and they had hair dryers in the men's locker room, and all sorts of things that, believe me, were a complete change. But I was smart enough, at least, to change and not go in and try to drive a stake in the middle of the whole thing. And I learned a tremendous amount by working with those guys for a couple of years, and learned to respect them and really realize that a long haircut really doesn't mean anything about what a person is like.
That's a good lesson to learn.
I could still say something about guys wearing, blank this out, about the pants falling off. I could still have a conclusion about that might not be the most popular political thing, but that would be my opinion anyway.
Right, absolutely. Do you think the response of the Olympic Committee was appropriate at that time?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I think at that time it was.
Okay. Do you think has your opinion changed over the years?
Well, again, it would have had to been handled differently with the team, from its conception, instead of all of a sudden something like that jumping out at you.
Yeah.
And you've laid no work for it or anything. But I think that I certainly, if that would have happened on our team, I would have been for expulsion from the village the same way at that particular time.
Sure.
And even now, it's hard to say. You know, I've gone through so much. When I first came here in 73, they were just, we had like one or two black players on the football team and one basketball player.
Right.
And, you know, I've been right in the middle of that and been, of course, I'd gone to school with Mexicans and blacks and played with them at East L.A., and I grew up in that type of neighborhood. So
sure.
That's been, that has been very easy for me, you know, for me to accept.
Sure.
That, you know, the problems that they've had. And I can remember I won a trip when I was 14 years old as a newspaper carrier to New York, Washington, D.C., and Chicago for 2 weeks.
Wow.
As one of seven carriers in Los Angeles. We had to go out and get subscriptions, and I won my area. And one of the boys we couldn't take with us because he was black.
Wow.
Been able to stay in a hotel with us in Washington, D.C. Chicago was okay. New York was okay, but our nation's capital. And
that's wild.
You know, I was 14, I was floored by it, and I suggested that none of us go. I said, if he can't go, I don't think we ought to go. And they compensated him with money, and he didn't go, and we did. But I was absolutely shocked because I had never heard of, you know, anything like that, you know, that a black person couldn't stay in the same hotel where you were.
Yeah, no kidding. Absolutely. Do you have any recollections about the media in Olympic, in the 68 games? Cameras, photographers, reporters, did they...
Hold on just one second.
You have reached 752380. Reached 752380.
Okay, it looks like we've lost Coach here for a little bit, so I'm going to try to get him back on the line. I apologize for that.
Hello?
Hey, Coach. It's...
Yeah, I'm sorry. Listen, that phone I was on is just, it has a charge on it, and it ran out.
Oh, I'm
and
sorry.
And in between that, by the time that happened, then somebody else called. My wife was on the phone. It answered the phone. It wasn't you, so that's why you got cut off.
No problem at all. I was hoping nothing happened.
No, I apologize.
Not at all. I'm all good. We're going to start talking a little bit about your recollections of the media. And what was your impressions of the press or anything else? Do you have any about a big deal, how big of a deal this was?
Okay, now, big deal about the track situation?
No, just unless you have something else to add about that,
I think, you know, I think we've finished with that anyway. I really don't have any more, and it afterwards it became a much bigger deal as time went on.
Agreed.
And it was at the time, and especially at the time in the village. Now, I don't know how it affected track and field people, but we were through swimming.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. What kind of coverage did you guys, do you remember getting? Did many people pay attention to the swimming as events?
They were full, and they had one kid, Felipe Munoz, who won the 200 breast. And, of course, that we had an American coach that all of us knew that was coaching the Mexican team. And when he won that event, why, it was unbelievable. that made the whole Olympics for him. They'd had another young man in the 1500 that had broken the world record the summer previously. I mean, that summer earlier, 2 months earlier, and he had a terrible meet, and they booed him on the way out, which was terrible. I mean,
oh, gosh.
The guy just choked and got beat and didn't even medal, and they booed him on the way out. And then, of course, the other kid was the hero of the meet because he did win a gold medal.
Yeah, no kidding. Wow.
And he later went to Texas and swam, by the way. I suppose you know that.
Yes, sir. did you have opportunities to call back home and actually and talk to your wife?
My wife was there.
Oh, outstanding.
She went down, and, you know, I put her on the tour with Swimming World, and when they got down there, the seats that they're supposed to have, they double sold. So she didn't have a ticket. So I put a sweat top on her and took her right down on the deck, so she sat right with the team during the whole meet.
Well, then.
I mean, the security in those days, you could do things like that. Now, of course, you wouldn't even be able to get close to the pool.
Oh,
alone,
heck no.
You know, get down on the deck. But it was different then, all the way up, still up that way, I guess, until Munich.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. Yeah, no kidding. Your swimmers did really, really well in 68, for sure. What were your do you think the high altitude or anything else had any effect on them at all?
Well, I think it did definitely affected Mark Spitz.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he was young and had been built up so much, you know, that they were talking about would he win 5 gold medals or, you know, things like that. And he was still, you know, just a senior in high school.
Yeah.
And, well, actually, he just graduated that summer, you know, but he was going to, in fact, he was coming to Long Beach State. I had recruited him.
Mm-hmm.
And after he swam with George there, and I swam, I had the other two butterflyers, 100 and 200 flyers, that worked out with me, and they both beat him. And then he went on a trip to South America, and the Indiana team was down there. And, or no, I guess when he came back from Brazil, he stopped through Florida, and they were there, and he spent a day or so around the Indiana team, and he came home and called me up and said he was going to Indiana instead.
Oh, wow.
Which was a real, we didn't have a letter of intent at Long Beach because the basketball coach didn't want one. At that time, if you didn't have one, you didn't have to subscribe to it. So if he could go over and get a UCLA player at the last minute to come to Long Beach, why, that was okay. So we didn't have it because Jerry Tarkanian didn't want one.
Right.
So I lost Mark Spitz. But in retrospect, he did the right thing. I think his age and everything, that I think that he was probably a lot better off as an older, more established guy like Doc Councilman. I don't know that I could have done the job with him that he did.
Right. Are there any other members?
Would like to try.
Yeah, no kidding, right?
We had a picture on that David Zad and I. We'd gone down to Acapulco with the parents after the games.
Uh-huh.
And Zad and I went out fishing, caught sailfish, and had our pictures taken with them and like that. And we had one sitting downstairs of the two of us framed. And while I was talking on the phone and he was telling me he wasn't coming, my wife went down and took the picture out and tore it in half and threw his dad's picture away.
Well, that's a good partner that you've got there.
Right,
absolutely.
Right. She took it to heart.
Absolutely.
I've always got along just fine with Mark, and you know, I think it was probably the right decision for him. Who could ever quarrel with it anyway?
Sure, absolutely. Are there any memorable or interesting experiences about your first the 68 games that you want to share or anything?
You know, the whole thing was, you know, was really exciting for me, and especially the month in training camp. I mean, gosh, to spend a month up there working with, you know, the best swimmers in the country. You talk about, you know, learning things and picking things up, and it was just, you know, it was just beyond anything I could even conceive of to have that, and then to go down to Mexico, and we swam the second week, so we had almost three more weeks with them down there.
Yeah.
And never did really have an argument or fight or any real disruption between myself and any of the swimmers, or actually between the swimmers. Some of them had a little problem, you know, teasing Mark and things like that because he was young, and I remember when he was, they had a outbreak of cholera.
Uh-huh.
So we all had to get shots. They gave them to me in the rear, and Mark's scared to death of the needle. And so we had to all line up. We're going in. They'd take us in one at a time. You'd bend over a bench like give you a shot, and the next two guys come in. Anyway, when Mark went in, he was scared to death. He was just shaking, and he got in there, and they shut the door. And he had his pants down, and just getting ready to give him a shot, and the guys jerked the door open and took his picture. And then in 72, when I went with him to get his shots, because we had to get shots at Munich, too, and I told
sure.
him, I said, now, he has a lot of problems with shots. And he was sitting on a tall stool, and they went to give him a shot. His eyes just rolled back his head, and he fainted.
Oh, gosh.
But when the guys coming out before Mark, when he was in line, I can remember he was racing Doug and Ken Walsh was, and Doug were coming out, and they just had their shots, and Doug pretended like he fainted, and Ken caught him and drug him off, and you know, Mark's eyes were getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Oh, gosh.
Doug Russell is just, they played him.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's probably the most mild forms of hazing I've heard of in quite a long time, so that's not too bad.
The other thing I learned to do was wash my own clothes, which I'd never done, between my grandmother and my wife. Went down with Brian Jobe and Zach Zorn when we were up at the Air Force Academy, and I had clothes down there, and I went down there, and they took the wash machine, opened up, threw all the clothes in it, and he said, put your clothes in there, and so I put all my clothes in there, and of course I put Levi's in with white T-shirts, everything like that, and everything come out blue, and everything, there's all come out blue, and I said, well, these all, and they said, that's all right, it doesn't matter, you know. My wife couldn't believe it.
Now, they put you in the stands for the opening ceremonies. What about the closing ceremony?
The closing ceremony, I know I went in with my wife, and we sat in the stands for that as well.
Yeah.
And the athletes marched. And we were out there. It was a terrible crowd. I mean, just there was no lines or anything. It was just a mess, like Times Square. And trying to get in, and there were actually people fainting, and they started shooting some fireworks as just kind of a come on to this celebration thing. They're going way up in the air, and so the wind was blowing, and it started blowing, and some of that hot sulfur was dripping down in the crowd and hitting people and burning them, and so
people
started panicking. It got pretty hairy.
Oh, wow, no
and
kidding.
We finally got in, and everything was okay, but it was scary.
Wow, no kidding. Gosh.
My senior year in high school, I had played football in that same stadium. We went down, team I was at Long Beach, or at Los Angeles State.
Uh-huh.
We went down and played Mexico University. They had American football team, and we went down. So I'd played football in that same stadium where they had the Olympics.
Wow. Wow, imagine that.
They dressed it up after that, and, you know, more stands and things, but same field.
Sure. Wow, amazing that. So right after the games, you went fishing?
Yeah, sounds like? We went to Acapulco, and his dad and I went out, and we got along very well with Spitzes. He was somewhat of a case. His mother was just a doll, but his dad was, you know, he was famous as a kid was coming up, telling him there's only one winner in any race. The rest of you are all losers. Second doesn't mean anything, and stuff like that, you know. And so Mark had a hard time with the way his dad, you know, had handled him. And
right.
He finally moved him from George over to Sherm during, you know, before the Olympics, actually.
Wow. Wow. How long did you stay down there before going back to work? Or
I guess we were down there 5 days or so.
Yeah. And then you went back to work?
Went back to work, started coaching and getting ready for another season. But that Olympics was, I recall, end of September, early October. It was late.
Yeah, it was kind of late in the year, absolutely. You were already matter of fact, a lot of the athletes had to sit out a semester.
Well, yeah, Mark didn't enter school, so he didn't enter his freshman year until January.
Right.
I don't know that anybody... you know, that was on the swim team and spent that month up there. I don't know that anybody went to school that first semester.
No,
they were able to still compete. In other words, a basketball player was down there, could come back and not even be in school and join his college team. They made the NC2A, which is quite unlike them, made a dispensation for that.
Right. And saying it's not like them is absolutely, that is absolutely an exception.
That's right. They usually aren't that cooperative.
And you were only in California, one year after that, or 2 years? Because you went to Harvard in, what, 72, 73?
71.
71.
To Harvard. I was there 71 and came to Alabama in 73.
What was that decision like for you?
What, to go from Long Beach to Harvard?
Yeah.
Well, they approached me at the NC2As. They were in Ames, Iowa, and the coach Bill Brook had been there in about 25 years. He'd been head coach, I don't know how many years, but he'd been assistant to Hal Ewing before that. He was only the second coach they'd ever had. I was the third since 1930 or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And they called my room and said that they had an interviewing committee there, and would I please, between heats and finals, come in and talk to them.
Hmm.
And I said, sure. So I did. And, you know, I really wasn't looking to go anywhere or had any idea about it.
Sure.
And so they talked to me for a while, and that was basically it. I come on home, and then later they called and said that they'd like to have me come back for an interview. And I thought, well, you know, I've never seen Harvard. That's a nice trip. I'll do that. But I really didn't. And when I was going back there, and when I got off and it just ended the winter, and then it would look terrible. I mean, there was all the sand they'd put on the road that gets thrown up on the sidewalk and all over everything,
yeah.
You know, during the snow, and no leaves on the trees, and very dismal. And I thought, no friggin' way to come here. And by the time I spent 2 days there and interviewed with them, and they took me around and showed me all the difference of, you know, here's where Kennedy lived his freshman year, and they had his name on the door in the dorm in the freshman yard, and you know, showed you all things like that, and the Gutenberg Bible, and you used to see all this stuff, and you can't help but really be impressed. And the stadium, I think, was built in 1898 or 1902 or something like that, and the football stadium.
Yep.
And the pool itself, I thought, when I walked in, I was really afraid because I heard so many bad things about it, but it had surround seating, just real steep, like you almost like it used to be at boxing matches,
uh-huh.
And it had a 6-lane, 25-yard pool, and very narrow decks, about 12 feet or something, you know. So it was a pit, but it was just striking. I mean, gosh, I thought, man, this is really a theater, you know?
Sure.
So anyway, by the time they started asking questions, and I felt like I was playing them on the interview. They'd say, well, we're planning to offer $14,000 for the coach that we hire. And I said, well, if I were the lucky person to be selected, I said, I would have to have at least 16. I said, to move my entire family, sell our home, and come 3,000 miles up the country, you know. And they said, well, if we hired you, we'd probably go 16. And then they said, we're thinking of a four-year contract. And I said, well, I think they said 3 year. I'm not sure. But anyway, I said, well, you know, again, I couldn't think of leaving Long Beach and where we're at. And we're number five in the nation. And we've won the U.S. Outdoor Nationals the last 3 years. Then I would have to have at least a contract for, you know, for 5 years. And they said, well, if you were the lucky recipient, why, we would give you a five-year contract. So, you know, I was beginning to feel pretty confident in the whole thing.
Right.
And then I left and flew home, and a week or so later, they called and actually offered me the job, and I told them then that the next thing I'd have to do would be fly my wife back and see if I could convince her to take it. So we went back and looked at houses and, you know, decided to take it.
Uh-huh.
And, again, I had to leave. That was coming up to 1972, so I made a deal with him. And immediately after the NCAAs, I could go back and coach the swimmers I'd been coaching, you know, through the Olympic trials, and I was, you know, on the 72 staff, so
sure.
they allowed me to do that, and I was able to, you know, to go back at the end of that first year. We went in as number six in the conference and won it the next year.
Wow.
And they went on then and beat Yale then.
Yeah.
They didn't use, I don't think they've lost with Yale, but about once since that time.
Wow, that's
completely
amazing.
Turned Harvard Yale upside down, and Yale never came back.
That's amazing. So, can you pinpoint what your biggest influence or motivator to continue going, getting better as a coach throughout your career? You had a really long career, and I know we're talking about basically about the beginning of your career. But looking back about all the success that you had and your swimmers and the influence, can you think of what some of your biggest influences were?
Well, you know, I think certainly having early on in my career like that, to have a swimmer like Sharon Stouter, who at 16 years of age won 3 gold and silver medal, and, you know, broke 2 world records, broke 3 world records, 100 fly, 200 fly, 100. Oh, no, she did not break the 100 free, but she first American to break the 1 minute mark. But having somebody like that, you know, really helped a lot. And then I, right after that, had a sprinter, Zach Zorn, that broke the world record in 68 and 100, and Greg Charlton, who broke the 400 world record.
Yeah.
And then Patty Coretta, who broke the 1500 world record at 13 years of age, and she broke it by 15 seconds.
That's amazing.
And have that much success that early, why, you know, I don't know how I could have been that fortunate. It just, it was really very, very fortunate. And as I look back, I don't regret. There's only one decision that I even have any thought about it at all, and I still would do the same thing. But Daryl Roer called me about the Texas job.
Uh-huh.
And I'd only been here then, I think, 2 years, and my son was, no, we've been here a little longer than that. But anyway, my son was come up, was going to be a senior in high school, and was on the football team and captain of the team and things like that. My daughter just entered college,
uh-huh.
And I'd moved. I had 7 jobs in 15 years.
Wow.
And so I told him, I said, I would love to say I was a candidate, you know, for the Texas job. I'd love to work there.
Yeah.
And but I tell you who ought to hire. And he said, well, who's that? And I said, Eddie Reese.
Huh.
And he said, well, I don't know really if we could afford him or anything like that. And I said, I'll tell you how you can afford him. And he said, how's that? Start a summer swim camp and give it to him. So they gave him a job like it. Whatever, 12,000, another 12,000 to some camp, or whatever it was in those days.
Right.
And Eddie got that job, and I got him out of Auburn.
Yeah.
I didn't have to compete again.
That's
We've always been great friends, but that's the absolute truth. I was glad to get Eddie. And then Richard Quick came down there and got him down to Texas as well.
That's outstanding. That's outstanding.
Well, I'd always felt if I could get it, Oklahoma, Nebraska, Notre Dame, Alabama, Texas, any great school that had a great athletic program, if they put the funds in it, that you could build a great swim team there. And I've been proven right by several people that have gone to these other schools and done the same thing. Nebraska, for a while, did really well in swimming until they dropped it.
You're right, absolutely.
And Notre Dame has never really ever put anything into it to really develop their program, so they've always been just so-so.
Sure.
Oklahoma at one time is very good in swimming, and of course, Texas has been great.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Thanks for telling Coach Royal about Eddie Reese, that's for sure.
Well, he already knew about him, but for some reason, it was like, I think maybe he talked to him, and I don't know what Eddie was making or what he said or anything like that, but he said, I'm not sure we can afford him. And I'd started and been doing swim camps a couple of years, and, you know, there were years, a lot of years that I made, paid more money in taxes than I made work at the University of Alabama.
Sure.
And, you know, and so Eddie and they've had a great swim camp there ever since.
Absolutely. What are tell me about your impressions or what your personal experiences with amateurism and eligibility rules and gifts in sport like that. Things have changed quite a bit in the Lambs in your tenure as far, I know, for recruiting purposes, but as far as everything else, can you take...
When I was at Long Beach State, I had $200. I had a $75 charge card and $200 recruiting budget.
Uh-huh.
And we went from never scoring the NCAA in 4 years, from 11th to 7th to 5th to 5th in those days.
Right.
And in Harvard, you weren't allowed to go off campus and recruit.
Uh-huh.
So then I came to Alabama, and when I first came down here, well, they had 24 full scholarships. And by the time I got here and took the job, NCAA cut it to 18, and within the next 2 years, it cut it to 12
yeah.
or 9. And that was, you know, we were, in 3 years, we were second place in the NCAAs, but I had no more money, and they'd cut the scholarships. And if you can't have scholarships to get somebody to come to Alabama, I couldn't get them to come, because the swimmers were all in Florida and Texas and Pennsylvania and California and things like that. And to leave all those schools and come all the way down here to go to Alabama without money. Why, you know, it just, and all the schools around us have, around the state of Alabama, all have scholarships coming from gambling funds of one sort or another.
Uh-huh.
that pay the tuition fees for in-state residents, and we don't have that. So we were really, really at a disabled position.
Sure.
Now, don't ask me why or how the Auburns won 12 national championships. I don't know. But they did an unbelievable job. But it really is, you know, it's a tough recruiting situation. We don't have a high school pool in the state of Alabama, and the only meet they have for the state championship, they have a two-day meet. They have prelims one day and finals the next, and all the kids swimming in clubs can represent their high school and come down there and swim, and that's it.
Wow, I did not know that.
And I had to work with the athletic commissioner of the state to even have that, so they could at least win a high school letter and have some high school recognition for, you know, for swimming. But they don't swim dual meets, and there may be a couple of them, like in Birmingham, or where they have a few more clubs where they have a couple of high schools that have a dual meet or two. But when I say a dual meet or two, I mean one or two.
Wow.
And other than that, they swim one high school meet a year.
Do you think it's easier now for because of endorsement deals and sponsors and things like that for Olympians to actually compete and train than it was, say, back in '68 when your Olympic career kind of started?
Well, it certainly is, and that's one of the reasons that you see all swimming, you know, not all, but a lot of the best ones swimming to 26, 27, 28. When Mark Spitz finished swimming, he was 21 or 22 years of age.
Yeah.
How good could he have been in another 4 years had he been paid and, you know, and essentially been a professional? How many more medals could he have won? He certainly would have been in the running for more in 4 years.
How do you think that reflects on, you know, the idea of amateurism as far as,
well,
like, the Olympics go? What are your feelings on that?
Well, there is no amateurism in the Olympics, and the NCAA is the one that makes it tough on the athletes in college. But to my estimation, if you want me to tell the NCAA what to do, I could tell them a lot of things to do, but I've got a really great recommendation for them, and that is make the money sports just what they are, football and basketball, keep them that way, and take all the other scholarships and make them basis of need.
Mm-hmm.
Because you got doctors' kids all over on full swimming scholarships that don't need them. And then take the money that you're not spending on all that, when and let the kids, that the endorsements that they make, let them set up an account. When they finish their education, then they can get that money, and they can be, you know, if they represent Pepsi-Cola, that money goes in there, and it's there for them when they get out of college.
Wow, that's pretty good advice. I agree with you.
One of the reasons I went to Harvard is I thought that the way the funds were going then, it looked like they were going to take the scholarships away from all sports with football and basketball just because of the money situation. And I went to Harvard because I thought, well, they made it all a basis of need. This would be a great school to be recruiting at.
Wow, yeah. So, Coach, if you gave one piece of advice for an Olympic hopeful, what piece of advice would that be if someone wanted to be, like, either as an athlete or a coach?
Well, as an athlete, well, and a coach. An athlete has to be consistent and has to work every single day. You got to take your lunch bucket and go to work and work. You can't, well, there's a football playoff tonight, or there's a basketball game I want to see, or there's a movie I want to see, or my friends are doing this. You know, you have to be consistent and dedicated. And I think coach the same way. I never sat down a single time during my entire coaching career. I never allowed any of my assistants to sit down. And it just, you know, it's something where if the swimmers can swim, you can stand. And I think, you know, you've got to be completely dedicated. It's a tough thing on a marriage and a family.
Sure. Absolutely.
My daughter, when she moved here, she was swimming and had done, you know, real well. But I'd never sit down to dinner with my family until we moved to Alabama, and I didn't coach club team anymore.
Ah, there you go.
I always had a club team after college workout, stay another until 8 o'clock at night and coach another workout.
Wow. What do you think, looking back, what do you think the significance of the 1968 Olympic Games have been, either on the impact on your life or as a game, since you have vast experience in many Olympic games? Do you think 68 games stand out in any way to you?
Well, it was my first opportunity, and you know, I'll never forget any of them except the Moscow Olympics, which we didn't get to go to. But you know, it was just, I was complete idealist. You know, I thought the greatest thing you could possibly do would be on the Olympic team and represent the United States, you know, and as a coach or an athlete.
Yes.
And it just was, to me, was, well, in sport like swimming, that's about the best you can do and best you can be. They've, you know, started world championships. I was on a couple of those staffs. But you know, it's not the same as the Olympics.
Right. I agree with you. Do you think this oral history project is going to absolutely help in any way or leave a legacy to your family or you?
You know, I don't know. I like to do anything I can, you know, to help swimming, help further swimming, and anytime I can go speak to a group or anything like that, I do, simply because I want to try to give back anything or as much as I can, you know, back. I just don't have any idea where I'd be coming out of a little town in Kansas if it hadn't been for athletics, especially in swimming in particular. But I wouldn't have gone to college if it hadn't been for football. The only reason I went to college, I was an industrial arts major, and then at my last year, I decided I wanted to go to college and play football longer. So I went to junior college and played football.
Yes, sir.
And then I ended up getting married after the first year. And if I hadn't gotten married and married to a woman that I'll celebrate 60 years with next month, or in March,
congratulations.
I never would have would have finished college. I would have, you know, gone until I finished playing football and or whatever, and gone and done something else and been a mechanic or something.
Sure.
So I'm thankful for, you know, for athletics especially and swimming in particular.
Yes, sir. Is there anything else that you'd like to tell our audience about the Olympics or the 68 games or anything?
Well, you know, I served a couple of years in the Navy as well.
Yes, sir.
And the one thing that, you know, that always means so much to me is every time I hear the Star Spangled Banner, I get goosebumps and teary-eyed because, and it's a combination of, you know, the time in the service and the Olympics and how much it meant to, you know, represent the country. And it's a very patriotic thing to me when they have, you know, the opening ceremony and the Olympic team walks in, things like that. It really means a lot to me, and all the award ceremonies when they're raising that flag. Why, it really hits home with me, and I hope that the kids, even though they're professional and swimming for dollars and a living and money and things now, I hope that they still get some of that feeling.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Great. Well, I want to. Do you have any questions for me, Coach?
No, as you go through all this, if there's anything that's not clear you want to call back, feel free to. And I'm just glad to see, you know, anybody giving any attention to something that may further swimming. And you know, commend you for all the hard work you guys are doing. I don't know how you're going to get it all together, especially if you talk to everybody in every sport that was on that Olympic team. My Lord.
We're doing a pretty good job. it's a labor of love.
Is this a class project that you're on?
Yes, sir.
Is this a class project that you're on? Or?
No, I'm a master's student here, and I'm around athletes. It's just a project of Dr. Thomas Hunt, and this is his project that he has started. And any opportunity I have to interact with Olympians or world class athletes or coaches, I avail myself at any opportunity for that. Because it's an opportunity to learn.
Well, I'm sure it's time consuming too.
Yeah, it's great, but we have a lot of great people around here, so it's pretty good. I want to thank you, Coach. Thank you so much for being
okay,
so generous.
And like I say, if you need to piece anything that as we went from place to place and back and forth, you know, feel free to call back. I'd be glad to help.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you again for your time, Coach.
If you see Eddie, tell him I said hello.
Yes, sir, I will.
All right.
Take
Bye.
Care.